Working Cows Podcast, Episode 100.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Hi, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows podcast. We made it to episode 100. Really appreciate all the support and all the feedback and so much great interaction with you guys through the different channels, and I hope that it continues. Glad to have Burke Tiger here with us today. Burke is known for managing some of the largest ranches in North America and has done it successfully at a high level for a long time. And so today I wanted to sit down with him and pick his brain for a little bit. So, Burke, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows podcast.
It's a pleasure. Glad to be with you.
So I would like to understand, if you were found yourself at a ranching event, a continuing education event, so to speak, and you walked past a group of people and you happened to hear one of them say, you know, it's hard to find good help these days. I think you're known for hiring the best people. And so how would you respond, or what would you be thinking if you heard someone say that?
Well, there are a lot of thoughts that come to mind. First is that I think the word, when you talk about hiring help, the word help becomes demeaning. I think you want to hire team members if you can. And I think we still can. It has never been easy. It has never been easy to hire the right people and people that can make good team members and help your operation move forward. I've made a lot of mistakes, and I think I got better over time through interview process, etc., in finding and placing better people with our operations. But it just never was easy. And I think we try to depend too much on finding somebody that's ready-made, and they're probably not there. I think I have had some reputation of just hiring better people. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think we just hired people, and then we tried to have a system or a method of development that helped those people become what they could become. Not sure that we as a group were a lot smarter than everyone else or a lot better. I just think we came to a system that helped us all get better and to move forward, and we developed a shared vision that helped us all move together simultaneously and work to help each other grow. I guess one step further that I might make a statement on there is that I get a little aggravated when I hear people say, hire this guy and he doesn't see anything that needs to be done. And then when he does see it, he doesn't know how to do it. And I want to suggest, did you ever tell him what you wanted him to do? What you wanted him to look for? Did you ever train him, show him how to do it? If we're managing at a level above the common and the ordinary, which is what we should be trying to do, Any new employee deserves to be trained, and it's unfair to them not to train them. And so I think that becomes a big issue. We expect to find people ready-made, and there are a few, and I was fortunate to hire some of those. But most that we hired were not ready-made. They had to become.
So I guess I want to go back just a little bit to something you said earlier about making mistakes. Would you say that the worst managerial mistakes you've made have been in the area of hiring people, or are there other areas that you would say maybe are more important or bigger mistakes that would trump the things you've done as far as hiring people?
Oh, I don't think we ever made big mistakes in hiring people. we hired some people that didn't work out, and usually they left of their own accord fairly soon. Didn't fit into our group, and that was especially true as our team developed and became quite good. We were probably not a very hospitable place for bad apples. You know, people that couldn't deal with the level of management that we were employing, and I don't know if they just felt like a misfit or they could recognize that they didn't fit in, that they weren't carrying their load, or that they weren't understanding and learning quickly enough. But typically they left fairly early. I don't recall having to fire a single person. I think we put a very few on probation, and of those that we put on probation, as I recall, most of them quit. They resigned. They didn't try to, you know, work through their work plan and make things better and preserve their position. They just left. But I hesitate to call those mistakes. I just think bad mistakes anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I just think there's a certain amount of that that's important. You know, I did learn, we took a lot of student interns. And I learned that if we hired somebody who had been a student intern with us as they were going to college, and we'd been able to work with them and they with us, and if we still liked each other and still felt a fit, that those that had come to us as student interns and then we hired back, they were the easiest to be sure were going to work for us and fit. And those were really truly great hires. But you know, we had some opportunity to get acquainted with each other, and that needs to go both ways. I mean, people need to make sure they're going to fit with us. We need to make sure they fit with us. And an internship is a good opportunity to let that happen. So, no, I wouldn't. I would say our biggest mistakes probably came in the area of not giving new people as much opportunity to get better, to improve, and to fill their role correctly. It was a bigger mistake than hiring them in the first place.
What training curriculum, in your mind, has tended to produce those best equipped to take an integrative and holistic approach to ranch management?
Oh, that's really difficult. You know, if I could start with a youngster in high school that wants to work in farming and ranching, I'm not sure I would, you know, ideally, you know, you want them to have a degree simply because that's a passport to a lot of things. And there are a lot of people out there, employers out there, that won't hire a person without a degree. And so I'd probably encourage a person to get a degree, but I'm not sure they need one. And they're very costly anymore. It costs a lot of money to go to college. In fact, I think it costs a lot more than it should. I think universities are doing a lot of things that are good, but at the same time, they're doing a lot of things that don't need to be done. And if we could just, one thing is general education. I'm a believer in general education, but I'm more and more a believer that general education has to come through living in life and being attentive and paying attention to what's going on in the world around us. Now, there's a lot of people that don't do that, but that's what we need to do. I'm not sure we can afford the luxury of getting our general education at a university. I think we need to go and get equipped for a career and the ability to make a living. The indebtedness loads that students take on to go to college or that their parents take on to send them to college, to me, is just not wise. And for example, if you could go to 2 years of just a good community college close to you and emphasize some biology and some chemistry, which is the foundation of all of agriculture, if it's well taught and you learn it well, good biology, good chemistry, some business, accounting, and economics, general economics, and I'm talking introductory levels, accounting, so you can talk to an accountant with some intelligence, and an ability to communicate. Anything you can do in the way of communication, whether it's reading, writing, speaking, or listening, courses that can help you with those things, and get those, if we could structure the right internships with the right leaders for those people following that kind of academic background, they could become far better managers than most of the kids that graduate and have degrees. And it's not a very nice thing to say, but I would say that 2/3 of the kids that graduate with an agricultural degree have a diploma and a degree and very little education. Somehow we've got to convert that into education. And they and their professors think that they're ready-made ranch managers, and they are not. In my time, we hired one foreman, and it was a disaster. The rest of them were made. They came in for the entry-level herdsman, cowboy positions, college graduates included, and earned their way up. And I think our young people have to expect that that's the way it's going to be. That coming out of the doors of the university doesn't qualify them for very much. It helps, and I don't mean to demean the college education. Certainly it helps. But some of them learn it, and some of them don't. And some of them have learned how to memorize and regurgitate and pass tests, but they didn't learn how to retain and keep and really build truly an education. And I've certainly seen the whole array of that, you know. And having said that, I've hired people with master's degrees that have been very productive for us, very, very good, and to the top. On the other hand, I've hired people with no degrees at all that have been very, very good and moved to the top. And I think the ability to be a lifelong learner is just critical in that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I compare those two, the one without the degrees with one with, the ones with the degrees were able to help us a little more with the technical aspects, say nutrition, reproduction, that sort of thing, because they'd learned it. And they were among those students who got an education while they were getting their degree, and they learned it and learned it well, and they could teach their coworkers because they knew it and understood it at a fairly high level, and they could help their coworkers learn things about reproduction and nutrition and genetics and, you know, that whole genre of events and or not events but of understanding and learning. And help them do a better job.
So you mentioned.
I don't know if I'm answering your questions very well.
You're doing great. No, I appreciate it.
That's kind of some of the feelings I have.
Well, you know, I just heard an article the other day or read it. I don't remember if it was on the radio or if it was something I read, but that some people in my generation are going to retire with college loan debt because the college loans have gotten so expensive, or the college educations have gotten so expensive that they're taking on so much debt to get these degrees that they're going to end up retiring with that debt. So
I have great concerns about that. And I just don't think it's right. And I think somehow our educational systems have to be willing to think through that and help us do better, because I believe in college education. I believe in general education. But I think general education is becoming a luxury that we can't afford in our preparation to earn a living. And somehow we're going to have to figure out how to work through that, because we've got to do it with less indebtedness. And two, we need somehow to get students to become serious about getting an education and not just getting their degree.
Sure.
They can have a little fun while they're at college, but that's not its main purpose. you need to go there and learn how to learn how to become a lifelong learner and start building a bank of knowledge and understanding that as you leave the university, you continue to build on. And, you start to build a network of people that you know can be helpful to you as you go along. And, I look at things that came from my own college experience. you know, I started building a network of people, and that just moved on. And today I have a network of people in academia that I respect and work with and talk to and get information from. And boy, they're wonderful. They're wonderful, wonderfully helpful to me. Even now, as I work as a consultant and speaker, that I can still draw from these people. And, so that network is great, but I also have the other network amongst the farmers and ranchers out there, the people that, frankly, they lead the researchers because they're always a step ahead. And then the researchers come along and validate. But I think that's a great combination, you know, right. People that are at the cutting edge. I once heard a man, I think it was Herman Cain, in fact, say, you know, I'm not sure I want to be at the cutting edge, but I for darn sure want to be on the blade. And you know, and that makes a lot of sense. How do we stay on the blade? And I think that's through network. So you know, you start with a high school graduate, get the right courses, and don't dodge the ones that can be helpful to you. I mean, yeah, chemistry and biology aren't a lot of fun to take as courses. Take them anyway and learn them, because it'll be fun to have that knowledge once you start to apply it to how does a plant grow. How does a cow's body function? How does nutrition work in that cow? And if you understand biology and chemistry, you're going to understand that so much better. And then you can go talk to a really good nutritionist, and you're going to understand his answers a whole lot better. He can dig a lot deeper with you because you've got now the understanding to be led there. You know, the same would apply with accounting. If you've had enough accounting that you can talk intelligently with your accountant, oh, you can get a chart of accounts that works for your ranch that's so much better than if you just take what the accountant gives you, where he doesn't have or she doesn't have a lot of understanding of your business and agriculture in general. If you can work with them, it just makes so much difference. And so you build one piece of knowledge on another, and you know, it boils down to the fact that, okay, so I go to college, it's supposed to give me a leg up, it should give me a leg up if I take the right courses, and, you know, and if you're going to get the college degree and you're going to have to take a lot of general ed, in almost every general ed group that I was required to take anyway, I didn't always do it because I was still young and dumb, but I could have taken courses that would have been helpful along the way. You know, I just hope that we can reduce the cost of this thing, though, and I think if we can't, then there has to be an alternate way for people to become managers without having to spend all of that money on an education.
Sure.
And I think I'm a real believer in internships, and they have to be well structured, and the people providing those internships need to recognize that they have an obligation to teach. And if they don't teach, it wasn't an internship, and you shouldn't even call it that. It just became low-paid help, and you know, and that's not what you want. You want bright young people that have capability to learn, and then you better have the capability to teach. But you know, knowing how to provide a learning environment for an intern is no different than providing a learning environment for a new employee.
Yeah.
Managers just have to become teachers. That's all there is to it. And the ones that aren't teachers are the ones that complain about the kind of people that they hire because they're not able to teach them. And it's unfair not to.
Yeah. You've mentioned twice now being a lifelong learner, and you've run some of the largest ranches, but still, as I understand it, seek out knowledge and attend schools and workshops. Can you talk about some of the benefits for you personally and why you're still seeking some of those resources out?
Well, I'm probably addicted, but I can't help myself. I have to be a lifelong learner. I just, you know, everything I learn new just spurs a desire for more understanding still. And, you know, I almost hate to admit some of my things that I now determine are shortcomings. You know, I started many, many years ago. I got into hearing about more advanced grazing. And so, boy, I was thinking, okay, I loved cows first. You know, cows are what I wanted, but gosh, if I can do this grazing and I can grow more grass and run more cows on the same ranch, I kind of liked the idea of that. So I was cows first, now grass second. Well, I kind of knew that our grazing was doing something with the soil. And I'd hear little tidbits, and I'd log those into my mind. But, you know, it took me way too long to really get totally serious about that and recognize, hey, it's soil first. And if we start to get the soil right, the plants that are grown in that soil will just sort of be what ought to be there at the time. And they will be more nutritious. And there will be plants that are medicinal and all kinds of things that it creates a healthier animal and greater carrying capacities. You know, and you start learning those things a bit at a time, and you start putting the pieces together, and then you start thinking, okay, what am I? I'm still missing something. I'm sure and we've learned so much about soil. And when I say we, and I'm not nearly the leader in that bunch by any stretch of the imagination, not even close. I'm just a follower. But when I say we, I'm talking about the whole community of practitioners and scientists and everybody else. We know so much more about the soil now than we did 20 years ago that it's, you know, it's just amazing. And 20 years ago, man, I hate to date myself, but I was near retirement 20 years ago. You know, I was 10 years away or so, a little more than that, but why do you wait to the end of your career to start to gather that stuff, you know? And anyway, that's why being a lifelong learner, it's blessed my life. You know, I mean, first of all, I established a network from whom I could gather information. And a lot of that network early on was in academia. Later on, it became good ranchers and some farmers that I could see were applying principles correctly and making wonderful progress on their farms and ranches. And, you know, and being profitable and had ideas for profitability. And so build that network and then just, you know, learn from the network. So it continues on. Every once in a while, a good book is written. And you read it. I mean, I'm sure more often than that, but right. I'm aware of a few that are really helpful.
Where should people go to learn how to continuously improve the key resources of land, cattle, and people? Is there a source that tends to kick out the best individuals who are prepared to continuously improve the key resources?
Yeah, that's of the things I call the five essentials. That's essential number two, is to strive for continuous improvement of the key resources, land, livestock, and people. And land is good grazing and management of the soil. And there are some holistic management certified educators, HMI, you know, there's Kurt Z is one of them that's been there a long, long time. Roland Cruz is another, if I think long enough, I could name another one or two. But at any rate, there's several of them that are very good. Now there's a new, fairly new Soil Health Academy, and that's a combination of Gabe Brown, Ray Archuleta, and Alvin Williams. And boy, that's a power-packed deal. It is good. And they offer courses and advertise for those courses. But those guys are really, really good. And, you know, and you can go to Alan's ranch or Gabe's farm and you can just see it happening right in front of your eyes. And so those are places that, you know, that are really excellent for land improvement. And they're not the only ones. You know, the Ranching for Profit School, they get into all three of those aspects a little bit. And then there are Soil Conservation Service, local conservation districts, I should say, along with University Extension, and sometimes those people even combine. But I've been a speaker at those kind of events now for the last 5 or 6 or 7 years, and some of those programs are extremely well done with very good speakers with good levels of competence. And I'm just a believer that we have to be willing to go to those kind of things. And I know at our ranches, the ones I managed at any rate, we expected every full-time employee to have at least one significant off-ranch learning experience every year. And that could be a three-day short course or a school of some kind, or it could be maybe one or two of these one-day events that I'm talking about. But anything they went to, the expectation was when they came back, when they came home, they were to teach the rest of us what they had learned. Now, you think of that. If I've got to go and I've got to come back and teach my coworkers what I've learned, I'm probably going to learn it a little better, right?
Right.
And so
take better notes.
That was the idea, you know, that they come back. If you know you got to become a teacher about what you've learned, you're gonna try to learn it a little better. And that varied. I mean, some of them learned it really well and came back and they made a nice presentation to us in staff meeting of what they'd learned, and it was good. And we'd then discuss and sort of try to solidify that a little amongst our people. Some of them came back and didn't, obviously, had learned very much. And maybe they'd learned, but they weren't very good at presenting it yet. But we wanted those opportunities there for lifelong learning and going on. And they're just events out there. So that's land. Livestock, you know, I'm for the improvement of livestock. I firmly believe that there's got to be two breakdowns anymore. We've either got to develop maternal herds, and those of us that are raising our own cows, raising our own replacement heifers, we better be developing maternal herds, and they need to be environmentally adapted. And I'm not sure, and I don't want to toot my own horn, but I'm not sure that there's very many people beyond me, and Kit Farrow, and two or three others that are really teaching that kind of stuff. I mean, Alan Williams teaches it, but he focuses a lot more on the soil, you know, that have a method. How do I structure a breeding program? Johann Zietzmann from Africa, he teaches some of these principles in his book, Man, Cattle, and Felt, BELD. Mm-hmm. There are a few, but most of them are still terminal crossers, even though they raise their own replacement heifers. They're raising cows that are really should be, the females should all be slaughtered because they're built for growing carcass. And as a result, the fertility of the nation's cow herd is diminishing every year. And I think we're starting to see some turn in that, but not nearly rapidly enough. And I got caught up in the same thing. But anyway, there are a few out there that can help you understand how to select for environmentally adapted cattle that fit your environment, can be highly productive. Now, the terminal side of things, that's pretty simple. There's a lot of good terminal bulls out there. That's what most of them are made for, in fact, that can grow and make good carcasses. And if you can mate those bulls to really good cows, the results can be wonderful. But you can make those bulls to just run-of-the-mill cows and still come out with darn good results. So that's an easier side. And what you're trying to do in reality when you improve livestock is to say, okay, I've got an inventory of so many head. Let's say I've got 1,000 cows and replacement heifers to keep that pipeline full. But I want that inventory. If it's fairly fixed inventory from year to year, I want the value of that inventory to get better and better. You know, through age structure or through quality, one of the two. And that's how we work on improving livestock and making them more environmentally fit, environmentally adapted, so that I can spend less money on them and get the same or better result. Just don't have to spend as much in feed and supplementation and that sort of thing, and that's improvement of livestock in my way of looking at it.
Can we, before we move on to people, I do want to ask you about how do you go about making the decision between a maternal and a terminal herd? Is it based on the resource base of the operation? Is it just based simply on goals of the manager? How would you go about making that decision?
Well, I think the goals of the manager are probably the most important thing. Some people just can't stand the idea of buying somebody else's cows to run on their ranch. They want to make their own replacement heifers. Sometimes their reasoning is really poor and really flawed when they make those choices, but I think that's where it has to start. If we can make a wise choice, it's what really fits the personality and what we're doing and what fits the resource that we have. Those are the two criteria I think one needs to use. Okay, choose between terminal and maternal, and how does it fit me, and how does it fit where we are? And, I've got a friend that's a wonderful manager, and he worked with me for a number of years, but he's terminal crossing in a big herd, and he tries to buy late calving cows from fairly established breeders as his replacement cows. And he does quite a bit of that, but he usually has to go to the auction and to fill his annual order, his annual need for replacement cows, because he's running a lot of them and he needs, you're going to have to replace a fair number every year, but it works even with the cows that came out of the auction barn. I mean, there's some good cows there too, if they're pregnant cows and going to calve somewhat in his season. So that's what he does and makes it work. If the guy were to decide he wanted to make his own replacement heifers, he'd do that just as well as he's doing what he's doing, but just because he has those kind of skills and abilities. But and he did that on other ranches that he worked for before he went to where he is now. I just think he thinks that the resource better fits what he's doing.
And now the continuous improvement of people, where would we send people to learn how to do that?
Well, I don't know that you send them. I just think there's a few key things in that. There's always some good books on that. Good to great, right people, right seat on the bus. And, there have been people that have written over time that Stephen Covey's Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, which has been around a long, long time. And I just got a couple of books the other day by a guy named Patrick Lencioni. The ones I happened to get were The Four Obsessions of an Extraordinary Executive, which is very good, and that looks at it from kind of the leader's standpoint, and the other is The Ideal Team Player, and, how do they become ideal, and how do we help them become ideal? There's always stuff to read about that, and I think if you once get into some of the literature, and you get into it, why things keep coming your way. And I in recent years, I just haven't emphasized that quite as much because my speaking engagements and my consulting engagements have sort of led me in another direction. But I think there's a couple of things. One is, I frankly don't think we're very good bosses, any of us. And so we don't want to be bosses. We want to learn to be leaders, and we want people to become self-supervising. Now, initially, when people first come to work with us, you have to be boss, want to or not. And you have to give them some directions, some training, and help them develop. But as they grasp what they're supposed to be doing and how to do it, and that becomes evident, then better than a pay increase is that you give them more autonomy. And now that doesn't mean it substitutes for a pay increase, but it's better than, in terms of their satisfaction and their enjoyment in the job. If you can begin to give them autonomy and you trust them now, you know they can do the job. And in agriculture, we're pretty far flung. A lot of people spend a lot of a day working by themselves. And so the supervisor just can't be there all the time. And so I think, first of all, I don't think we're very good bosses. And then second of all, we need to reduce how much time we spend being boss. And we need to become very effective and very good leaders. And I don't even know how to define leadership, but it is best gauged by the voluntary response of those being led.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think the manager's job is best defined this way, is to create an environment in which people want to excel and then provide tools training, and freedom to do it. Tools and training naturally precede freedom. You got to have the tools and training. They've got to demonstrate that they can do it. As soon as that is demonstrated, then freedom. And, you know, creating the environment in which people want to excel, I just think that's to create a shared vision that everyone can buy into. It's exciting. It's why we're here. It's what we're about. We need to answer why before we answer what. Why are we here? Do we have a purpose? You know, and we need to talk about it both as an organization. Why is this ranch here? Why are we part of this ranch? You know, you speak about the purpose of the ranch collectively, or you can talk about it individually. Why am I here? And we need to answer those questions in such a way that it sort of fits everybody. But anyway, we need to create a shared vision. It starts with why are we here, and then goes on and say, okay, what can we, as a team, what can we really get excited about? What makes it fun to go to work every morning? I mean, there might be some miserable, blizzardy days that really aren't very much fun. But, I mean, but if it's all part of your mission, in spite of not being fun, it's somehow satisfying. When I was stupid enough to steal calves in the wintertime, I remember helping working with a bunch of heifers, and I had some student interns at the time. But I'd come home from church on a Sunday afternoon, and listen to the radio on the way home. The blizzard was about to come in and about to hit, and I just saw a whole bunch of heifers at one end of the calving lot. In fact, going into labor, I could see that they were. I went to the house, grabbed something to eat, and put on my work clothes and my stuff that would keep me dry, and headed out south with my horse. And I didn't see my bed for about 36 hours. I just, you know, but I caught little snippets of sleep here and there, but didn't go back to my house, just in the calving barn. And
right.
While that was not what you might call fun, there was some satisfaction associated with that.
Yeah.
If you can understand that. Knowing that we were saving things, that, you know, and like I say, you couldn't pay me enough to get me to calve in the winter anymore. but those kind of days come. I mean, it creates a certain amount of physical misery for you in the agricultural business, but in the meantime, you're doing things that prevent catastrophes from happening or getting worse, or to pull out the other end of it and be okay. And so there's satisfaction attached to that. And so as we create this environment in which people want to excel, it's got to make us happy to go to work in the morning and happy to work extra hours when that's what's required. And has us looking forward to the result. You know, if I change my grazing method, boy, I just get anxious as can be to see how soon I'm going to be able to increase the stocking rate because the carrying capacity is starting to build. If I do things to change my cattle, what's happening to cull rate? You know, what's happening to herd fertility? And, you know, you start looking forward to improvements that you think are going to come. The marketing plan or changes in things we're doing. How's that affecting the cash flow? And so if you can create that environment in which people want to excel, that people can just get excited about being there, doing what they're doing. I think that's really part of the key. And then ordinary people will become much more than ordinary. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I don't know that we have to hire much above average. It'd be nice. I don't know that we have to hire much above average for those very same people that aren't much above average, and I got to throw myself into that category. I think we can become far more, you know, if we're properly led, and if we have programs and methods to help people develop their full potential.
That's great stuff, and I really appreciate it. Today's show notes page is going to be workingcows.net/100. This is episode 100 with Bert Tigert, and I really appreciate your time today. I got a few more questions for you. what are some good sources for planning and decision-making tools? Where would you send people, or how do you equip people with good planning and decision-making tools?
Well, you know, our smartphones, tablets, computers started, and we, you know, first of all, I don't believe in keeping on a commercial ranch at least a lot of records, but I want the basics. And a lot of them are just annual. I want a periodic inventory. I like inventories done every month if our size is very big. And it doesn't mean I go count cattle. It means that I know what last month ending inventory was, and I know the changes in this month. I know the number of births, I know the number of deaths, I know the number of sales. And that leaves me, and I know the number of purchases. And so I can take class by class, and I can project from the beginning, and I can go from the beginning of the month to the end of the month. Now, we know that over a course of a year, there could be some unobserved death losses in some country. And we know we could forget something now and again, but not too much. At least once a year, we want to count. And then we adjust our book to that count. But so a periodic inventory, that is a springboard for a budget. Let's say that I'm now in the month of August, and in September we're going to budget for the following year. So we get to this August 2019, and I'm going to project, and I've got inventory forms that let me do that. I'm going to project from the end of August to the end of December. And then I'm going to have a beginning inventory by age class going into next year. By that time, pregnancy testing will have occurred, weaning will have occurred. So as I go into next year, the calf that was weaned here in the fall, I'm going to call that a yearling, an H1 or an S1, if it's steer or heifer. And then my bred yearlings, my pregnant yearlings, they're on the end of December, they're going to become H2s or two-year-olds that will calve sometime next spring or summer. So I'll change my age classes, advance them all one, and then I've got those age classes now, and nutrition requirements, supplementation requirements might be a little different for each of those age classes. But now with those numbers, and knowing how our preg rates have run over time, I can project a calf crop. I can look at my marketing, and so from those numbers, I can quickly do the return side of my ledger for a budget. I can also quickly budget for all of the non-overhead costs or the direct costs, the feed, supplements, marketing costs, and vet costs, vet medicine, vet services. From those numbers, I can just do it quickly. So having a periodic inventory and a good form for doing that, and there's several of them out there available, but the Ranching for Profit School has a nice form. Mine is a little different than that, but very close. They could say one of us borrowed from the other and and probably not be too far wrong, except we probably both borrowed from the same source originally. I picked the form up from a professor at the University of Wyoming when I was doing my master's degree many, many years ago, and then I've modified the form a little bit but the basic layout of the form, it's herd classes down the left-hand column, and across the top, you're setting up each of your columns with a, you know, like, I'll start with beginning cattle class, beginning inventory, number born, number purchased, number transferred in, number transferred out, died, sold, and the inventory. So you can make your age class changes in that, and mine modifies from that a little bit. But those kind of forms are out there and available, and I wish I could give you a quick address. I can't, I'm afraid, but they're out there and available, and that's the beginning. And then, you know, a good accounting program, and if you're small, people that understand and can use the classes on QuickBooks can do a really nice job. And it seems like almost everybody that I've done consulting with has either already gotten there, or I can help their accountant. If they have an accountant and they're on QuickBooks, I can help them shape it up. Now, some people are on very good and very sophisticated accounting programs, and they're just okay. The thing that most of them don't have is a good separation of direct and variable costs, and they get a convoluted chart of accounts that mixes overheads and direct costs. I think they just alphabetize or something. I don't know what they do when they put their chart of accounts together, but they're not in sensible groupings. And then sometimes the chart of account is so restricted that it has feed in there and if I've got five classes of feed that I want to track, I'm hard pressed to do it. It takes an act of Congress and a lot of time spent with your accountant to get it fixed. But the development with your accountant of a sensible chart of accounts becomes really critical. And if you don't have one, a sensible chart of accounts, fight until you get one. Because that accountant needs to do three things for you. The first thing they need to do is they need to report profit and loss to the owner with accuracy. Two, they need to be able to file a tax return that's honest and not going to get you in any kind of trouble. Number three, they need to provide managers with information that will help them make better decisions in the future. And from my role, number three was the most important. The other two are important too, but number three is really important because why do we keep records if they can't help us move into the future?
Right.
So a good accounting system, and then production records. And the production records are like animal days per acre, calculated for each pasture. I want death loss by class of animals. In other words, how many cows died this year? What percent of the total was that? How many two-year-old heifers died this year? And what percent of the total was that? How many yearlings? And calves, I'm just going to get a weaned calf crop percentage. And so I don't need the death loss for calves. It'll be in that weaned calf crop percentage. And so I want weaned calf crop percentage. And that is not per cow exposed. That is of the cows pregnant coming into this year, how many calves were weaned. And so that takes into account embryonic death losses, calving time death losses, summer pneumonias, any death loss that occurred between the time that cow was checked pregnant and the time you weaned the calves. I want to know that number. I also want to know pregnancy rate. And that's just a simple number. How many cows did I palpate or did I ultrasound, and what percent of them are pregnant? Just two numbers. Now, if people want to go back to cows exposed, which happened a year ago, and I like to stay in this year. I manage in this year. In 2019, right now, I want to manage for getting a cow pregnant this year, but I also want to get the calf at side weaned this year. And so that's the reason I focus on this year. That's where I'm budgeted for, and I want to perform this year. Wean this calf, sell this calf, get the cow pregnant with the calf for next year. Now, if you do want to compare or benchmark with those people that use the term calves weaned per cow exposed or pounds weaned per cow exposed, you can multiply this year's weaned calf crop percentage by the previous year's pregnancy rate. And that's a real good proxy. It isn't exact, but it's very close, and it's sure good enough. I want pregnancy rate, weaned calf crop percentage, death loss by class of animal, and animal days per acre. And that's, weaning weight. But it's not individual weaning weight. It's total herd weaning weight. If I throw all the calves across the scale, what's that total combined weaning weight? How many pounds did this ranch wean this year? And then I also want to know yearling gains. So if I keep some of those weaned calves over to next year, I'm going to weigh them separately, and so I'm going to have their weaning weight. Next year, we'll have that weaning weight from the previous year, and so I will be able to take the yearling weight, which is either a sale weight or a weight taken when I have a heifer diagnosed pregnant and I keep her, that weight, and so I can get yearling gain. And I like to say that weaning weight and yearling gain are really my ranch productivity. Yes, there's some gain in cow weight, but that's fairly insignificant compared to yearling gain and weaning weight. And I want to track those over time. What's my trend? Am I really producing more on this ranch every year or producing less? Or, naturally drought and rain are going to make some difference there. But I'd like to know what that trend is over a 10, 15-year period of time. You know, people can get those pieces of information, though, and put them in spreadsheets, and, you know, that's why the computer and the tablets, they're so easy to collect data and capture data pieces anymore, and then to analyze in spreadsheets, that there's no excuse to not. And really, it's not a lot of calculations. It's not a lot of stuff. It's just the right stuff to make good decisions.
What role do you think technology is going to play? You mentioned tablets and phones. What role do you think technology is going to play for the next generation of ranch managers?
Oh, probably more than it should. and I'm serious when I say that. Just because we can doesn't mean we should. I think we've got a young generation that are so adept with these devices, and they almost to the point that they're addicted to them. And if it can do this, we ought to be doing it. And that's not necessarily true. So I think the big challenge is going to be to say, of the technology available, what really makes sense for us to use?
Hmm.
And it might be different on different ranches. You know, certainly it's going to be there. I mean, things like bookkeeping and record keeping and all kinds of things. I mean, remote sensing. I know people now that used to pump water into water storages and then flows downhill from there to water tanks, and you know, they have to go turn pumps on, turn pumps off, and have to visually inspect and shoot. They're doing all that with telemetry from their house now. And you know, and so they don't drive out to turn the pump on unless they know the water levels are getting low, and telemetry means to do that for them, all that kind of stuff. And some of that's nicely valuable, you know, but there's going to be some stuff that, you know, you gotta question the value of, you know, genomically enhanced EPDs, I think, for example, are great. Using genomics to select replacement heifers, I think, is fallacy.
Hmm.
Now, there's going to be people argue with me on that, and that's all right. They can argue with me. But I think just getting heifers pregnant is the key. And the early pregnancy in a heifer tells you which ones are going to be the good cows. Now, that might not project their offspring as well, but hey, I'm looking for a good cow right now. I need cash flow. And the cow that's good now is what's important to me. And, you know, now the bull I breed her to maybe improve. And so I see that kind of technology working very nicely on the bull side, maybe not quite so nicely on the female side. Like I say, there's those that are going to argue with me, but I think we have to start thinking that way. How does this technology fit? And is it going to be a kind of a waste of time and money in some places and yet really hit a lick in another place? And, you know, the people selling that technology, and actually the more they sell, the better it is. It's like buying feed supplements. Oftentimes, the salesman would like to sell us more than we ought to buy most of the time.
Hmm.
We have to determine how much should we buy. And that's true with feed supplementation. It's going to be true with application of technology as far as I'm concerned. So one of the big decisions we're going to have to learn how to make is how much of this is applicable and isn't applicable now.
That's good. Yeah, discerning, definitely a discerning approach to that is going to become more and more important, I think.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I said I'm afraid that there might, you know, we might overdo it.
Yeah. What alumni have you found to be best suited for waging war on costs?
Oh, waging war on cost. It's a mindset. First of all, we got to examine overheads. Most of us want too much stuff. Too many pickups, too many stock trailers, too many four-wheelers, too many saddle horses, and in some cases even too many employees. And, you know, we've just got to learn to reduce overheads. The first fight in any management situation is to cut overheads to the bone. Just have what you need to have to get the work done. Now, we need overheads, no question. Without them, we don't function. We are overheads ourselves. So we've got to have some overheads, but there's a terrific tendency to have way too much. And so there's that mindset. And then after that, it's managing the inputs and outputs, feed and debt costs and those sort of things. And so we just have to make sure that a dollar spent gives us more than a dollar back. And I have some kind of rules of thumb on that. I want a dollar spent to give me at least $2 back. At least I want to estimate that it will. And that's to cover for my lack of precision and ability to estimate. And two, what happens if the price of the input should go up significantly and the price of our product hasn't? And now we've got the herd addicted to that input. And if we pull it away, what's going to happen to the performance? And so, but anyway, we got to get more than a dollar back for every dollar we spend on additional input. And it's just marginal cost, marginal return kind of concepts. But so war on cost is really a mindset. And we have to learn how to look at it economically and from a cost-benefit standpoint, but it's a mindset. Are we willing to do it? Will we do it? And then I'm convinced if you marry good accounting data, simple accounting data, I might add, with good production data and simple production data, weaned calf crop percentage, pregnancy rate, weaning weight of the whole herd, if we marry good accounting data with good production data and give it to every team member, whether they belong to the family or part of ownership or not, give it to every team member, over time we will make better and better decisions.
I want to ask for a couple of examples. First of all, you've mentioned a couple of times pregnancy rates. Is there a point at which your pregnancy rate is too high as far as these bulls cost too much to have around? Maybe you don't need every bull that you have because you're achieving these pregnancy rates?
I think most people run more bulls than they need anyway if they're doing BSEs or if the bulls are decent bulls. Bulls will get a lot of cows pregnant if they're good bulls and they're adapted to their environment. And I don't think that affects pregnancy rate. The thing I worry about most is that people have 96% preg rate or a 95% preg rate, and the feed salesman comes along and wants to sell them a little more feed that'll increase their pregnancy rate by several percentage points. And I'm going to say, how much more can you afford to feed 100 cows to get two more pregnant? and now it's one thing to look at a 95% preg rate and do I want to improve that versus looking at an 85% preg rate or an 80% preg rate and do I want to improve that? And the answer is yes, you do, and you better. But those high pregnancy rates, you got to say, can I afford to, does it make sense to try to improve this preg rate? And I think anything from 94 on up is really questionable. How much do you want to try to improve that? Because you could certainly spend more than you can get back.
And the second example I'd like, do you have a rule of thumb for how many cows a pickup and a trailer should service? Do you have anything like that you think about?
No. You're going to tie that pickup and trailer probably to an employee.
Right.
And maybe you'll split, maybe two employees will share a pickup and trailer, the big rig kind of outfit, and then they'll have smaller conveyance, either a small pickup used Nissan or Toyota, or Ford has a little one and Chevy might too. And anyway, a small pickup that just roused about, or a side by side or a four wheeler that gets them to their. A lot of times they don't need to pick up a trailer at all for a week on end, weeks on end. You don't want many of those sitting around. But the key is how many cows can one man take care of, and then what equipment you need to tie to that employee to make them highly productive, and so that you build the overheads around the employee to fit what they're doing. And boy, if you can share some stuff to reduce overheads, that's all the better. But they do need a complement of tools to get their work done. So then what you're looking at is cows per man ratio, or cows per person ratio, I guess I should say, to be politically correct. What do you need? What do you need in the way of, how many cows can that one person take care of? And, our ranch is in Nebraska, which I was there longer than any place else, but we were at 800 plus or minus cows per employee, and usually a bunch of yearlings in addition to that. Now, those were in two herds, a yearling herd and a cow herd. And sometimes after the yearlings, if they were yearling steers and they marketed in the fall, why then they didn't have any yearlings for a while. But there's no magic number there, though. If you're a rancher and you're trying to be a full-time rancher and you've got 400 cows, that's going to be your ratio. Now you have to understand that you're at a disadvantage to those that are 800 cows per person. And so you might have to say, do I need a little bit of something else to provide a little more revenue so that maybe only half of my time goes to these cows and half of it goes to my flock of sheep or goats or to providing a for-hire service for a group of neighbors or, you know, I know all kinds of people that are doing those kinds of things. You know, I have a nephew, for example, wants to get into the cow business, is working toward it, and he trains colts, gets colts started mainly, and does nicely with that, keeps himself and his wife alive doing that, and anything the cows make, he puts back into more cows. And, you know, and so as you scale down, but you've got to recognize where your competition is, and then how do I reasonably compete with that?
Is that your advice for people who want to be first-generation ranchers or people who are first-generation ranchers, is to realize that you're going to have to supplement the income of the cow herd on the front end, or are there other approaches to that that you would take?
You can't step into ranching today with borrowed money. If you do, you're dead in the water to begin with. I mean, you can take beginning farmer-rancher loans and maybe buy cows with them, but you can't buy the land under those cows.
Right.
You know, so yeah, that's my advice. You probably need to start slow and have another source of income on the way in, or else you need to stack enterprises. You need to be willing to run sheep and cattle together, or goats together, or pasture layers, or who knows what, if you want to stay just at home. Or, you know, you need to go shoe horses for 15 different ranches, or, you know, there's a host of things you can do. If you're big enough now that you do have that pickup and stock trailer, do you custom haul for some people that need small jags hauled here and there? I see different people doing different things so that they don't have to account for all of their time against a smaller herd of cows when they're competing with people that have high cows per person ratio.
Right. So we've basically covered the five essentials. I've tried to lay it out that way. The last one would be, who or what have you seen produce the best marketing minds?
You know, I've seen a little here and a little there, and I don't know. There's some people who do a really, really nice job. You know, marketing seed stock is one thing. Marketing commercial cattle is another. So let me confine it. I mean, you know, I could say Leachman's and seed stock because, I mean, it's incredible what they've done. you know, but there are others who have done nice jobs, too, in the seed stock realm of marketing. Kit Farrow, you know, I mean, he sold a refrigerator to an Eskimo, I think. But seriously, he's done a very, very nice job of marketing.
Yep.
You know, there are others in that seed stock genre that do a great job. But in commercial cattle, I don't know, the things I've written, I think, have put most of the good ideas I'm aware of together. Selling late calving cows, I've found that I can sell bred cows for more than I can sell open cows most of the time. Not all of the time, but most of the time. And oftentimes, that premium is significant. And so I made a business out of selling late bred cows, cows that were bred later than our calving season. And there's always somebody calving then or going to calve a little later than then, and they're willing to let those cows buy them to calve in July and move them to September, for example. You know, you can just do that kind of thing. I don't know, you need to marry marketing with your production. And what am I trying to produce? And if I want a short calving season, I'll use a long breeding season, and any cows that don't calve in the calving season that I've defined for us, I'm going to sell to somebody else either as a pair or a bred animal.
Is that a relationship in marketing late calving cows? Is that a relationship with a consistent person that you're selling those to? Or do you?
Yes. No. What will happen? And at first, sometimes you just have to go to auction, and you try to establish a relationship with the auction barn. Say, hey, I'm going to come with these cattle probably every year for a while, and help me. Let's get them advertised. Let people know that they're there, especially the second time around, third time around. Let them know, hey, these cattle are back. And I think pretty soon people come to you. And, you know, I was lucky. I went to some people that I knew, and I knew they were buying replacement cows. And I, And I knew they were having to go to quite a few sources to buy them. And I said, maybe I can kind of be a one-source deal for you. And so we were able to sell them, you know, replacement cows, and kind of year after year. And then we even had the same order buyer that would pick up our odds and ends of those bred animals, the ones that these other buyers didn't take or didn't quite fit what they were after. And that same order buyer would find orders and sell the rest of them for us. And, you know, now you don't want to sell anything. You don't want to represent anything for more than what it is. But if you do a good job of proper representation of the cattle, you are selling what you say you're selling. You know, you'll make a mistake once in a while, and they'll forgive a mistake once in a while, but you better not make very many. You know, the cattle better be what you represent them to be. And then some of them you just take to auction and sell as is. But that's for your reputation that you do that. You know, you don't want to represent them as what they aren't. I wish I could tell you just where to go. I picked up an idea here and an idea there and from a lot of different people. And years ago, I thought I was doing a good job of marketing the odds and ends and the open cows and the late calving cows and all that. And I was pathetic. As I started watching other people do things and then hear a little there, a little, I just started putting things together. The open heifers, when we bred a short breeding season on the heifers, the open heifers became a very positive cash flow item for us, and then bred cows became a big deal.
So is there another place that I'm not aware of to go to get your back catalog of writings other than the Beef Magazine articles you've written over the years? Is there another place where they appear?
No, that's it. If you can grab my blog address off of there, well, that's probably the best there is, you know, and my blog address will give those articles from beginning to end, and it goes clear back to August of 2011, I believe.
Okay. I'll link to that at the show notes page at workingcows.net/100. I got two more questions. The last one is that I think we've kind of laid out your training program as it would be, and as I understand it, that would be a good general education from a local community college that includes good accounting, simple accounting, biology and chemistry, and then to intern at a ranch where the manager is committed to being a teacher, and that individual who is being educated would go to one significant off-farm learning experience every year. Is that a basic outline of how you'd like to
speak? That kind of outlines it, you know, and some people are late enough in their careers that they can't back up and start over, so they have to go from where they are, you know, and just learn what they can, do the best they can. You know, I would just say this. There's young people out there that have given up on agriculture because they don't think it can be profitable. They don't think there's a future. And some of them, if they know they can't go back home because the operation is too small or it's in some economic trouble of one kind or another, they just give up. And I didn't get to go back home either. And I wouldn't trade my career for a lot of the people who stayed on the farm, the home farm or the home ranch. I just tell people if it's your interest, qualified, there's going to be opportunity. There is opportunity today. I know people looking for qualified people.
And I've seen a lot of heartache come from people who did commit to coming back to the farm because things weren't laid out and then it didn't go as they thought it might.
Don't even go home if the transition planning is not in process, you know, and moving forward. My recommendation is don't go back home until that's in place. Doesn't have to be firmed up and finalized, but the talks have to be ongoing and we have to be moving in that direction. You know, and there's two kinds of transition. There's managerial transition and there's ownership transition. You know, and I don't blame mom and dad for not wanting to turn the reins over. And I won't criticize people for doing that a little slowly. But you need to have the process, and it needs to be understood and there. I mean, that's the reason I still work as a consultant and speaker. I didn't want to quit when I retired. And I wasn't forced to retire. I don't mean to imply that either. I just retired, but I'm glad I didn't go from there to doing nothing.
Right. Burke, I so much appreciate your time today. Last question. what's one thing you wish you would have known all along as it pertains to life and or ranching? And this comes from Tom and Taryn Dreeling on one of the Deseret Ranches in Nebraska. I reached out to them, and they wanted to meet to ask that question.
Oh, you know, it's been a series of building blocks for me. That's a hard question to answer. Let me think just a second. You know, I guess the thing that I wish I had known all along is that we won't live long enough to become perfect at anything we do. And two examples that I have of that are livestock handling and grazing, which are two of the fun things we can do as ranch managers. But we won't live long enough to get perfect. But every time we get a little bit better, we get rewarded. And so that just makes the challenge and the job of ranching so enjoyable, because there's always challenge ahead of us. We just know there's room to get better. And at the same time, as we get better, we're rewarded. You know, just that. And I can't remember when I picked up other things other than that. That took me too long to catch on to that, I think. You know, that and the concept of being a lifelong learner and just a network, a big network, but that's been part of me for a long time. A good network of people that can be helpful, from whom you can learn, and spread that across academia as well as other good ranchers.
Very good. Berg, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
You bet. My pleasure.
It was an honor to talk with Burke today, and an opportunity to sit down and talk to him about training the next generation of ranch managers. Really appreciate feedback, and if you have any thoughts or questions or ideas, go ahead and reach out to me at workingcows.net/contact. Hit me up on the Facebook page, facebook.com/workingcows, or reach me on Twitter at twitter.com/YPClayConry. Coming up next week, we are talking with Brian Alexander again, kind of a halfway point of his strip grazing experiment. We're going to talk about some of the things he's learned thus far. So really excited for that, and I look forward to it. And I will have this episode out to you, episode 101, next week as soon as possible on the Working Cows podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.